Radio.
The Glass Bead Game and Pope Emeritus Benedict. A talk by Anthony Crone for Scholarship in the Cathedral.
Thank you. Thank you for your welcome. Thank you very much. I think I have to disclaim, I think, part of the kind of introductions. I don't really think that I'm qualified as a philosopher, but I am, because of an unguarded casual conversation with Professor Nicholas Tonti-Filippini, now supposed to be doing some study under him as my supervisor. And I'm here tonight because of an unguarded conversation with Father Richard, which resulted in him saying, "Oh, that sounds interesting. Why don't you come to Sydney and give a talk about it?" So I'm glad to know that most of you, almost all of you, have not read the book, only because it means, I think, that without being tedious, I think I can helpfully give you an introduction to the book and tell you a little about what's in it. My theme that I will come back to, I hope, before the end, is that I want to suggest to you some connection between things in the book and some of the things in the life and work of Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI. But I'll come to that towards the end. So first, what is this book? It's a book by Hermann Hesse. It is his last great work. He wrote it in exile in Switzerland in 1943. He was in exile because he protested against the Nazis and objected to their nationalistic regime and their injustices. And so he went to Switzerland, where he stayed more or less for the rest of his life in self-imposed exile. He had written a number of novels which in different ways were concerned with themes of truth, reality, approaches to truth, especially by way of contemplation, which often involved his characters in stepping out of the ordinary day-to-day life. So, for instance, he has a novel, Siddhartha, which is very much based on the kind of character of Buddha, somebody who leaves his ordinary life and goes looking for meaning and finding it in different places and then not finding that those give him satisfaction. So looking for beauty, a young man looking for joy in love of a woman, in dealing in the world, in renunciation of the world and contemplation. He has another book, pardon me, Narcissus and Goldmund, where he balances two characters, Narcissus, an artist, and Goldmund, a scholar and an ascetic, both of them initially boys in a Benedictine monastery in medieval Europe. One grows up to be a wild artistic character living on the road, sort of looking for beauty in the work of his hands and in women and in money. And the other grows to be the abbot of the monastery, and they encounter each other several times. So, the Glass Bead Game. In the Glass Bead Game, it's a complicated novel. Its structure is, there is an introduction. It's written in the form of a history of a man, Joseph Necht. Necht is just the German word for servant. It's cognate with our word knight, so K-N-E-C-H-T. Joseph Necht is the master of the glass bead game in his prime. So the book begins with an introduction explaining to us who don't know anything about it what it is. So first there's the introduction, then there is a life of Joseph Necht, and then there are a few shorter pieces, some poems supposedly composed by Joseph, and three biographies written by him as formal exercises. The introduction is important, first so that we can understand the book, understand its context, the context of the story, but also because in a way it gives one perspective on his life. But by the time you get to the end of the book, I think the reader has been invited to take a different view. So, what's the glass bead game? Hermann Hesse imagines a world around about the 21st or 22nd century, and it's about 100 years or so after there was a great reaction against what he calls the age of the feuilleton, the age of the leaflet. It's the age of cheap, shabby, superficial scholarship, of study put to whatever will turn a quick buck, of people doing more or less what I'm doing, people coming in and giving short, potted lectures on topics to elegant audiences, but it may not touch them. And people doing it for money. And interestingly, he says one symptom of the age of the feuilleton is scholars who don't do it for the love of learning, but say scholars who are doing it for the Nobel Prize, which is quite a nice thing because he got the Nobel Prize himself, largely for this book. So he imagines a world where there has been a lot of distress and a lot of shabbiness, and there's been a reaction, an intellectual and a cultural reaction. And so, if you like, the whole of society has embraced a kind of ascetical approach to learning. And society throughout Europe, still within different countries, but society throughout Europe has been reorganized so that education is put entirely under those who are devoted scholars. And in order to have devoted scholars rather than cheap hacks who are scrabbling after money or honour, there is a province that is set up and an order. A province is called the province of Castalia, taking its name from Greek mythology and harking back to Greek notions of knowledge and muses. And there is an order which develops. This order is celibate and practices individual poverty. Boys, it is only boys, but boys in the ordinary schools who seem to be particularly gifted and may have an aptitude for deep scholarship are invited, if they wish and their families wish, to go to elite schools, and there they study deeply and thoroughly, and then they do further study, and then the bulk of those provide the teachers at schools and universities. But there is an elite of the elite who govern this separate province of Castalia. Okay, so you have an ordinary culture, civilization, people still study for the professions of law, medicine, at ordinary universities. But all of the teaching is under the control of the scholars of this order. The other part, I see I'm not going to finish this, so I'll just see what I can cut from my mental map. The other part of the province of Castalia and its life is the glass bead game. The glass bead game is derived from mathematicians and musicians who particularly are good at expressing concepts symbolically. And Hesse's insightful idea is that it may be possible, and perhaps should be possible, to express using symbols not only relationships, real relationships, between concepts, say, within mathematics. So you can write a mathematical equation using mathematical symbols, and it's all to do with mathematical ideas. Or you can write a musical score using musical symbols, and it's all to do with musical ideas. His idea was that it was possible to devise a method of symbols, a system of symbols, so that one could juxtapose concepts taken from different disciplines in real and meaningful relationships, and that there could then be a beauty about that. And maybe in a way, perhaps a kind of example might be a little bit like an abstract form of some of the best architecture, because in architecture you may find themes and ideas that come from different backgrounds. It is a bit difficult to visualize the glass bead game, the idea of this game, but it's important to understand the book, and that what it means is that he imagines within this world of scholars over a number of generations, they have become addicted to ways of laying out elegant patterns of relationships expressed symbolically between concepts taken from different disciplines. In order to do this, they study very deeply all kinds of knowledge, but mostly as an object of study, not in a way of creating new things. And also, they practice a kind of asceticism. They found that the spirit of the old age tended to surface because there were people who were very sharp, very witty, very smart, with great synthetic minds, but not very much interest or attention to beauty, who were very good at playing the game and laying out the symbols in interesting patterns, but just doing it as a very superficial thing. And so they bring into their life a discipline of contemplation. So you have, this is where I think my little background picture will stop, you have an order of men who commit themselves for life to celibacy and individual poverty, studying, and their highest form of recreation and interest is playing of this game, which might be a little bit like seeing what are the best and most beautiful patterns you can make with the different coloured tiles in the mosaic there. But each tile has a connection with some intellectual discipline. Okay, there's the introduction. The life of Joseph Necht, perhaps for the purposes tonight, it's enough to say that in some ways he's a typical product of his province, but with a bit of divine discontent, I suppose. He's a gifted boy. He grows up. He's invited by the music master, who's a very high official in the province, to go to an elite school, and he grows up and he studies. He becomes a member of the order. He then, curiously, because he knows that he has great talents and he fears the fact that he's looked upon by some of his young scholar contemporaries as a leader, he then buries himself for a number of years in research, digging very deeply into just all of the concepts in one particular game. And again, perhaps it might be like him setting himself to study each one of those mosaic pieces in order to understand the whole pattern. He is chosen to be the master of the glass bead game, but not until after he's had two very interesting experiences. Once as a private scholar, when he finds a need to study Chinese, and in order to study Chinese, he goes to a member of the order who has studied Chinese deeply, but has also become more or less Chinese, and has gone to live in a bamboo grove and consults the oracle of the I Ching, but is concerned with some kind of contemplation of reality that is a bit different from sort of becoming a master of all the entries in the encyclopedia so as to be able to interrelate them. The other thing that is different about his experience is he is sent as a kind of ambassador from the order of Castalia to the Benedictine order. Because as Hermann Hesse, who grew up with a Protestant upbringing, as he imagines this world about now or in 100 years or so, Protestantism has very largely disintegrated as an organized system. And there are really only two organized bodies that in some way are dealing with scholarship. And they are the Order of Castalia and the Catholic Church. And they live in some kind of tension. And he's sent to a Benedictine monastery, which he finds intriguing and engaging. And he gets to know one of the monks, an historian called Father Jacobus, Father James. And he comes to a respect for the Benedictines in the beginning, partly by the simple fact that they're 1,500 years older than his own order, but also because they have a kind of unhurried peace, which he finds puzzling. He becomes master of the glass bead game, which is the highest office in his province, an office of tremendous respect, and it involves him in deep works of scholarship, in leading the whole province in exercises, in ceremonial exercises of playing a very elegant game. Perhaps for the elegance of this, you might try to imagine something like, perhaps it would be like a very elegant chess game played on an immense board of pieces representing concepts from different disciplines, mathematics, music, art. So he leads an elegant playing of the game. Then he resigns, to the surprise and dismay of his colleagues. And he resigns because he is concerned that the province, while beautiful and devoted to something good, has lost contact with the concerns and the needs which are apparent in a study of history, but that are at the heart of what goes on in the rest of the world. Now, I said at the beginning, and this is important, that the province and the order were set up really because the whole community, the whole of the country, thought we need to have people devoted to scholarship in order to teach us. So that's a relationship of value and respect. But he's concerned that more and more the cult of the glass bead game and the cult of very, very disciplined but aloof studies has put a vast gulf between the order and the rest of society. He goes off, he seeks the approval of his colleagues to resign, which they don't give. But then he says, well, I don't need your approval in order to resign, so I resign. And he goes off to teach as a tutor the problematic adolescent boy, the son of one of his own old school friends, but a school friend who did not go into the order. And then he goes out with this boy, and the boy, in a rebellious moment, decides to swim across a lake. And Joseph, on one version of the story, dives in after him, perhaps to race him, or at least to be in company with him, and he disappears and dies. So the first part of the book is your sort of introduction to this odd world of Castalia. The second part of the book is the life of Joseph. And the third part are some biographies that he wrote as exercises and some poems. There are three biographies he wrote. One of a shaman in a prehistoric community, a weather prophet responsible for making the rain and looking after the weather of his community, and his name is Necht. And in the end, the rainmaker sees that it's necessary for the good of the tribe that he should be sacrificed, and he acquiesces in that. His second life is of Josephus Camulus, Joseph the Servant, Joseph Necht, who is a desert father. Have any of you read tales or stories or writings of the desert fathers, especially from ancient Egypt? Yes? A much smaller, shorter book, and probably an easier read, is Helen Waddell's Lives of the Desert Fathers, short book, classic, full of entertaining and enlightening things. But you'll find in that book such intriguing people, for instance, as St. Mary the Harlot. I'll leave you to chase her up. So he writes a life about a desert father, and in this case it's a desert father who begins to doubt his vocation as a confessor, and because he's very gentle, his name is Joseph the Servant, he begins to doubt whether he's doing any good at all. And he's heard of another confessor and father, a very strict man, and goes off to meet him to seek his counsel. They meet each other. Each of them has doubted his vocation. And together they live for the next few years in harmony as two hermits together, until the older one dies and says, it was necessary for the two of us to meet so that we could both, by God's mercy, be cured and find again our confidence in our vocation. And his third one is a life of an Indian boy seeking meaning. And he encounters a holy man in the forest, and he asks him to teach him the meaning of illusion. And the holy man, without the boy realizing it, gives him a vision. The boy thinks it's real, of this boy growing up, being restored to his rightful place as a ruler, having a wife, having a son, having his wife unfaithful, being besieged, being defeated, and then awakening in the forest again to find himself there. So why have I gone through all of this? To show, I think, that there are some themes, and the themes of importance to Hess are especially circling around vocation and a person's sense of vocation and a search for the real in human relationships and the real in the truth that we grasp by the mind. Okay, I want to do two things before I finish. I'm just going to pick out maybe a couple of additional themes that surface in the book. And then I want to say a little about Joseph Necht and Joseph Ratzinger. So within this world of Castalia and the life of Joseph Necht, there are scholars and teachers and masters. There's the idea of an elite. There's asceticism in the service of learning in Castalia, and there's asceticism in the service of God in the Benedictine order. There's a devotion to a phrase that Hess uses in Latin, the universitas literarum, that is, the whole of letters or the whole of learning. And it's also clear, as it becomes clearer and clearer to Joseph Necht, that the world within this enclosed, elegant, sort of cushioned order of Castalia has an approach to learning which is really to do with a polished commentary on things already known rather than the creation of new things. About the only creative work that is done is the fact that each member of the order is supposed to write a biography of anybody once a year, and that Joseph Nick composed poems, which was regarded as rather odd of him. I think also it's true that Hermann Hesse, having himself been brought up within a German Protestant community, having rebelled against that, then having looked for truth in Oriental learning, found that at least he was intrigued by the Catholic Church and by the Benedictine order. Okay, so what on earth has this got to do with Joseph Ratzinger? I want to make it quite plain that what I'm going to say is in no way suggesting that Joseph Ratzinger decided that the best thing to do was to model his life on a fictitious character. But there are some parallels which are interesting between Joseph Ratzinger and Joseph Nick. And Joseph Ratzinger, as a young German, knew the works of Hermann Hesse, and different commentators that I've read, including Peter Seewald, who interviewed Ratzinger on a number of occasions, and perhaps most recently, I think, in his intimate portrait of Benedict XVI. He asserts that Ratzinger disclosed that he had a great liking for Hesse's novel Steppenwolf. Philip Nicholas Boyle, I think, president of Magdalen College, Cambridge, wrote an article published in The Tablet in 2008 in which he said, but he doesn't quote a source for this, that the glass bead game after the Bible and St. Augustine's Confessions was very high on the list of Joseph Ratzinger, Benedict XVI's favourite reading, that he thought it was a deep book. Certainly he was aware of it. So, most obviously, I suppose, there is an interesting parallel between somebody who, without seeking it and without setting himself on a path to find it, is elected to the highest office within his community. That he is so elected, having devoted his life as a committed celibate scholar, that while not a Benedictine, he certainly has a great respect and veneration for St. Benedict, having taken the name Benedict on his election, but also having received, I think, the St. Benedict Award for his scholarship. In fact, early in April 2005, just before his election as Pope Benedict. And of course, famously, he resigned. And I think Pope Benedict being Pope Benedict and being Joseph Ratzinger, the manner of his resignation, I think, is very interesting, that he resigned by delivering in a polished address in Latin to a meeting of the cardinals his statement that he had considered deeply whether he had the resources and strength of body and soul to continue with the office of Pope, and so he resigned, but in the most courteous and ceremonial way. Joseph Necht, in the story, writes a very long letter to his colleagues, the other masters, trying to explain his concern about the disconnection between the Order of Castalia and the rest of the world, and the need to attend to this, and seeking their approval, though knowing that he doesn't need it. So, what can be made of some of these parallels? Perhaps I should also mention that I think on his election as Pope, I recall that Pope Benedict referred to the bear on his coat of arms. Do you know about the story of the bear on Pope Benedict's coat of arms? The bear on Pope Benedict's coat of arms is called Saint Corbinian's bear. There was a saint who is the patron saint, I think, of Munich, who went on a journey to Rome, and he took his luggage with him on a donkey. And part of the way there, a bear attacked him and ate the donkey. And so Saint Corbinian said, "Well, you'll just have to take the luggage now." And so on the coat of arms of the Bishop of Munich, and then of Cardinal Ratzinger, and then of Benedict XVI, there is a bear with luggage strapped to its back. And I recall that he explained this shortly after he was elected Pope at an audience, I think. And he said that perhaps he felt a little like Corbinian's bear, and he wasn't quite sure when he would be permitted to return home. But so it would appear that perhaps at least he had in his mind the question about how long and in what way the Lord wanted him to serve as Pope. So are these little parallels of any interest at all, or just is this really just an exercise in the age of the feuilleton, just a frolic with no meaning? I don't think it is that. I think it's the case, rather, that Hermann Hesse is an intelligent man, and he's interested in how people flourish in community, and how they flourish as individuals and within cultures and civilizations, rather than with people just as masses or nationalist agglomerates. And recall that he rebelled against the National Socialist project in Germany. And so the qualities of an important human being that Hesse is interested in, I suggest, include these: intelligence and discipline as a scholar, lucidity of mind, a synthetic intellect, that is, an intellect capable not only of analysing, taking things apart, seeing how they work, and not just of putting them back together again, but of making new connections. He values and is interested in somebody with knowledge and respect for the tradition, but also having a creative ability. And I suggest that the balance of those two things, respect for tradition, which presupposes a knowledge and understanding of it, and creativity, flourishes most in people who have two qualities: humility and courage. Humility to understand the tradition and to have respect for it. Courage to see what may be the limits of the tradition, where it may need to grow, where it may no longer be necessary. And also, I think, Hesse picks a man as his protagonist who is chosen for the highest office in his society, not because he sought it, but because of his consistent, disciplined work as a humble, deeply intelligent scholar. So what I want to suggest, and you'll think it's a very little point that was hardly worth coming out in the dark for, I think, is that Joseph Ratzinger, expert at Vatican II, Bishop, Archbishop, Cardinal, prefect of the Holy Office and Pope. I think anybody who reads any of his works, including the short ones, I recommend especially, say, his Christmas homilies, which you can easily find on the Vatican website. He's lucid. He's a great communicator. It's very easy to see what he's saying. I think that the Church has been blessed by many popes with many gifts, but I can think of some of the predecessors of Benedict, whom I won't name, but I can think of some that I think were not particularly lucid. They got to the point, but really had to slog to find it sometimes. I think that there's a great clarity or lucidity, fidelity to the revealed truths, but also with a deftness enabling him to develop the tradition. And that I'd suggest to you, in that way, he's a scribe of the new covenant, bringing forth treasures new and old. One example of that, I think, at the beginning of Spe Salvi, his encyclical on hope, he suggests that really, from one point of view, faith and hope can be viewed as interchangeable. And the very opening words, the opening phrase from St. Paul, is that by hope we are saved. So he unpacks that a bit, and then makes a connection with suffering, and with hope in suffering, and faith, and an experience of hope in suffering that led, say, Josephine Baquita, slave girl, to accept Christ as her master, because he was a master who had suffered. But just the first few pages of Spe Salvi, I think, are worth reading to see the clarity of mind of Pope Benedict, but also the way that he puts together ideas which don't obviously belong together, and yet they work, and lead us to a deeper understanding of the truth. So, my first of my little points is that I think that the parallels are in here between Joseph Necht and Joseph Ratzinger, Benedict XVI. Because Hermann Hesse was interested in the highest qualities of human flourishing, and I think we were very blessed to have, we still are blessed, to have Pope Benedict Emeritus, who is one holy and eminent pope in the history of the Church. And I think the qualities that I've just listed, really, are qualities especially honoured by the Church, for example, in those that the Church has recognised as doctors of the Church. My last point, and then I will stop, is this, that a theme in the Glass Bead Game is Hermann Hesse's unresolved posing of the question about the relationship between aspiration for truth and meaning, how we go about searching for it, how we might find it, and how we might not find it. Perhaps in some of his other novels that can be seen perhaps even a little more clearly. I think that those themes, the quest for truth and meaning, have been, in one sense, themes which have occupied the Church from the time of Christ, because Christ is the way, the truth, and the life. He is the truth, and he is the way that we should be following to find the truth and to live it. But especially perhaps since the pontificate of Leo XIII, when popes have not had to grapple with the papal states and can instead set themselves to teach undistracted or less distracted, there's been a very clear focus by popes on these things. One obvious one in John Paul II's encyclical Fides et Ratio, Faith and Reason. So it's a constant thing, and John Paul dealt with it explicitly. You may be interested, if you want to follow it up, to see, for instance, that Cardinal Ratzinger gave an address to the American bishops in February 99 on Fides of Ratio, which was just a few months after it had been issued by John Paul. And themes that he picked up, that is, that Ratzinger picked up from that encyclical, is the theme of the universality of truth as opposed to the relativity of cultures. And I think that's a theme that one finds in the Glass Bead Game. Not resolved by Hess, but it's clear that he considers that whether you were in a prehistoric tribe, illiterate, or an ancient subsistence farming community, or in the desert with the Greek fathers, or anywhere at all, in a German elite intellectual community, or in the Benedictine Order, truth is something that one can aspire to and try to find. And interestingly, Cardinal Ratzinger said in that address that he picks up the point that St. Paul, having encountered the risen Christ on the road to Damascus, being converted, then abandoning the law which he had regarded as the way to life and salvation. But his departure from the law was a universalizing of the faith of Israel. Or again, the famous point in his homily on the eve of the conclave that elected him, where he denounced in the memorable phrase the dictatorship of relativism. Or again, famously at Regensburg, in his address to the university there in September 2006, where he alerted those who were there at the university to the danger of violence as an argument about the truth. And he went so far as to say, he says that the important bit about the interchange between the emperor and the follower of Islam was the proposition that not to act in accordance with reason is contrary to God's nature. And if we are to have some connection with God, then if we don't act in accordance with reason, we are rupturing that connection or making it impossible. I'm not suggesting that Hermann Hesse is the first to discuss these things, or that Pope Benedict is the first to live them to a notable degree. That would be absurd. I really, in a way, simply offer the possible relationship between these as reasons for us to go and think further about the nature of truth, the quest for truth, the need for discipline and contemplation, as well as for passion and engagement. And perhaps I'll simply leave you with one thought, which isn't from either Hermann Hesse or from Benedict, but I think both of them would agree. You find it both in St. Augustine and in St. Anselm. So St. Augustine, crede ut intelligas, believe so that you may understand. And then St. Anselm, unpacking that a little. First in the tag, which I think rightly describes theology, faith seeking understanding, fides quaeris intellectum. But also explaining, I don't try to understand so that I can believe, but I believe so that I can understand. Now that is a dangerous thing perhaps to propose, but I think it's essential, and even in ordinary human life, even in the most trivial encounter with another human being, one has to make some kind of an act of faith to get anywhere. And perhaps that gets us back, perhaps, to the danger, the courage, the need for faith for each of us in trying to find and to embrace either the deepest truth or to try to find and embrace a shape of life which is our vocation. I think perhaps humility and courage to recognize what we're rightly called to, what perhaps we might be called to leave. And not only Joseph Nicht or Joseph Ratzinger, but other people and some saints in the history of the church famously became saints by leaving things. St. Francis of Assisi, perhaps, and others. Perhaps I'll leave it there. It's rather open-ended, but in a way it's a sort of open-ended book.
That was Anthony Crone. For more talks from Scholarship in the Cathedral, visit cradio.org.au.